This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, when we meet somebody new, a common topic is what we do for a living. A guest makes the case that we can have better conversations and get to know people better if we don't start off with, what do you do? Now, the American Family Field, where the Milwaukee Brewers play, is slated for some renovations that could add up to something like $430 million over the next 20 years. And state and local leaders are debating how to pay for it. Governor Evers wants to use state money to pay for renovations. He included a plan in his state budget proposal. Republicans in the legislature say that the stadium is a local project that should be funded at least partially by Milwaukee City and County. We're talking about the Brewers Stadium and how hundreds of millions of dollars in renovations could be financed, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that state government should contribute, at least in part, to professional sports teams' budget needs and their stadium needs? Should that be done at the local level? Do you want to see no public money to go to these things? Is the revenue brought in by Major League Sports to a community enough to justify at least some level of government support? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Dakin is a business reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following this story closely. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
Before we get to the money side of things, who actually owns American Family Field?
Well, American Family Field is owned by the Southeast Wisconsin Professional Baseball Park District. Sometimes people shorthand call that the Stadium District. That's an agency that was created by state government back in the 90s that was created to oversee development and operation of what was then known as Miller Park. That entity owns American Family Field and leases it to the Milwaukee Brewers.
All right. And why? That's not that old, right? 90s. I remember all the hullabaloo when that got started. Why is there a need for renovations now?
Well, it's a big building that sees a lot of use. And over time, very basic things begin to fail, fall apart. Of course, you try and do the maintenance before that happens. And the catch here is that the Brewers have a lease that goes through the end of 2030. That lease obligates the baseball district, the baseball park district, to pay for major capital improvements. So there's a very specific obligation on the part of that state agency to pay for this stuff. The previous way of doing this was through that 0.1% sales tax that was in five counties in southeastern Wisconsin. That tax went away 3 years ago. The legislature and Governor Evers approved legislation calling for it to go out of, to basically be terminated. At that time, the thinking was that there was enough money set aside from that tax to pay for all these capital improvements going through the life of the lease. The Brewers felt differently, but they didn't say that publicly. They behind the scenes urged the stadium board to do a deep dive to determine whether there was enough money. The stadium district did hire a consultant. It did do a review, and that review concluded that the money set aside would be sufficient. But that review didn't go into anywhere near as great a detail as what the Brewers thought was really necessary. So the Brewers commissioned their own report, and it was concluded that there is actually going to be the need for about $428 million of work over the next 20 years when you factor in inflation, that tab rises to $448 million. Those figures were vetted by a consultant hired by the State Department of Administration, and that's the number we're dealing with right now. So what Governor Evers proposed in his 2023-2025 budget was to make a $290 million payment to the stadium district to help pay for this. That $290 million, combined with the interest it would earn over several years as that money was paid down to pay for all this stuff, and combined with another $70 million already set aside from that previous sales tax that since has gone bye-bye, that would cover all of this over the next 20 years, according to the Evers administration. And in return, the Brewers would extend their lease. I said a few minutes ago that lease goes to the end of 2030. At that point, the Brewers have an option to extend it, or they could choose to go to a different community. Under Evers' proposal, that lease would extend another 13 years to the end of 2043. So in effect, what you're getting is you're going to pay $448 million. You're going to get the Brewers here for 20 years. And what the Evers administration contends, and I have yet to see this actually challenged by anybody, is that the estimated state income tax and state sales tax generated by the ballpark makes the taxpayers whole over that 20-year period. In other words, the amounts basically balance out over the course of time. So we all start with those basic facts, correct? What has happened is Evers' budget proposal, as you probably know, was pretty much declared dead on arrival by the Republicans who control both the state assembly and the state senate. They want to see less spending. They want to see more money devoted to reducing taxes. And in particular, that $290 million that Evers would devote to the stadium, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has essentially said, that's dead. And we're going to start crafting separate legislation from the budget to face the stadium situation. And more recently, just this week, Voss made it very clear that he expects to see both the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County participate in that funding. He specifically cites the Pfizer Forum funding bill from 2015 that had a state, a county, and a city component to it. That's where we're at right now.
Talking to Tom Dakin from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the future of the stadium the Milwaukee Brewers play in, how much, if any, public money will go into renovating it in the aim of keeping the team in the city for a long time. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions to all of this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, you just mentioned Republican leaders say the city and county should be part of it. What, if anything, are you hearing from leaders at the city and county level in reaction to that notion?
Well, as you can imagine, they're not thrilled about that prospect. Both the city and the county have some real fiscal challenges, which both the Journal Sentinel and other news media have covered, which everyone acknowledges it exists. And part of what's happening right now with the overall negotiations about the budget, you've got County Executive David Crawley and Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson, who've been meeting with legislators from both parties and with the Evers administration to try and get more revenue sharing for municipalities, including Milwaukee. In addition to that, they would like to see the county given permission to increase its own local sales tax and devote some of that money to the city as well as to the county. So all this is kind of wrapped up. You've got the negotiations involving the overall budget. You got negotiations involving the question of increased shared revenue for municipalities. You've got negotiations involving the possibility of that sales tax being increased for Milwaukee County. And you've got stadium funding.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel business reporter Tom Dakin about financing or how to finance renovations for the American Family Field, home of the Milwaukee Brewers. It's an issue in the state legislature, possibly in the state budget or separate legislation, as we're hearing. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think renovations to that stadium should be financed? How much, if any, public money should go into it? If so, state money, county, city, where should it come from? Do you think it's worth some level of public investment to lock down the Brewers for a longer time into the future? As we'll hear, one Major League Baseball team getting ready to up stakes and move. Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel business reporter Tom Dakin about the dispute over financing hundreds of millions of dollars in likely renovations at American Family Field, where the Milwaukee Brewers play. Disagreements over where the money should come from, how much, if any, should come from state government, county, and local. You can join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. A little glitch with the phone line. If you had trouble getting through, maybe try again in a few moments. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Now, Tom, whenever we have these kind of conversations, there's always the question, well, would the team move? And we have news just today that one team's doing that, the Oakland A's, are going to be the Las Vegas A's, or maybe they're going to change the name. That doesn't roll off the tongue real well. Can you talk about the prospect for a team like the Brewers going somewhere else?
Well, that's the ultimate leverage every sports franchise, whether it's Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA has, is the ability to get up and move. And that's why these sports facilities are owned by the public, because the franchises themselves don't want to own it. They want to be able to rent. They want to be able to have the flexibility to get up and move if they don't like the way things are going. And communities generally agree to that if they want to have a franchise in their city. I mean, the Brewers have maintained publicly they very much want to stay in Milwaukee. But again, ultimately, we know that's the leverage they have. They don't need to bring it up. We all know it exists, right? So would they move? I don't know. But I think if you're going to be honest, if you're going to oppose this kind of funding, then you have to at least acknowledge the possibility of that happening.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
I love hearing your show, Rob.
Thanks.
We have I'm in Northern Illinois, and don't tell anyone I might be a closet Bears fan. I believe that they are negotiating right now with Arlington. I think it's the previous Arlington Park, the racetrack. I don't know if they're going to do anything, but so this sort of leads me to we're on the same topic, that doesn't having the Brewers in Milwaukee bring so much incentive for Milwaukee to want to keep them, as opposed to Green Bay or Madison or wherever else they might land in the state, thus making it less the state's problem and more the city's?
Gotcha. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. The economic stakes for Milwaukee City and County in terms of what having the Brewers there brings to them, Tom.
Well, let's break that economic benefit down into two sides. On the private sector side, yeah, arguably the caller is correct, because if people are coming in to attend games at American Family Field, if they're coming from Northern Illinois, for example, and we get a lot of Cub fans up here, and we get a lot of fans, Twins fans. I know a few in my family who come down from the Twin Cities. Those are folks who are going to stay overnight and presumably at a hotel. They're going to spend money on that. They're going to spend money on restaurants and other things. And that does provide an economic benefit to businesses in the Milwaukee area. But I would submit that is a relatively small fraction of the overall fan base coming to American Family Field. I think most people coming there are probably not doing overnight stays. And any economist would tell you that if the Brewers went away, the money being spent at the ballpark is discretionary spending, right? It's not like making your mortgage payment or buying your groceries or paying your utility bills. This is money you choose to spend there. So you would choose to spend it presumably on other forms of entertainment and leisure. The other side of the economic benefit is what I talked about at the beginning of this discussion, and that is the sales tax and the income tax that's generated by having the Brewers here. Think of the Brewers as just another business. Instead of calling them Milwaukee Brewers, think of them as ABC Widget Incorporated. ABC Widget Incorporated has a payroll. Thus, they have workers who are generating state income tax. ABC Widget buys goods. They're paying sales tax. That money isn't going to the city. That money's not going to the county. That money is going to the state of Wisconsin. And that's the strongest argument to make to say that the state should be paying for this, because the economic benefit generated is distributed throughout Wisconsin. Some of that money does come back to Milwaukee, as we said earlier, in the form of shared revenue. Milwaukee would like to get more of that back for obvious reasons. But some of it goes to Green Bay, some of it goes to La Crosse, some of it goes to Howard, some of it goes to Sheboygan, some of it goes to Wild Rose. I can start naming every obscure Wisconsin community, but you get the drift, right? So that's the way you have to look at it. And again, Speaker Voss, who's basically speaks for the Republican Party in the state assembly, doesn't really dispute that there is an economic benefit there, but I think he's still, for purposes of selling this to his Republican Party caucus, would like to see local participation in the funding end of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us next in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
So my question is, my understanding with MLB, NFL, each one of these different sports large franchises, is that there seems to be this sense that, this is always pressure on the states to perform, or they threaten us with this notion that they will pull out and go to another city. And, it seems like the intention is always to be kind of a symbiotic relationship. But, you know, more so now than ever, it seems like it's a little bit more one-sided. It seems like these deals are always kind of more upfront for the MLB or NFL.
I gotcha. And, Chris, thanks for the call. Tom, I think frustration with what appear to be big money sports leagues, Chris says, being able to rely on public money and threatening to leave if they don't get it.
Oh, sure. Every time I write about this, and I've written about it several times, I was the one who broke this story that this was coming, God, back in February of last year, 2022. Inevitably, I hear from people say, well, Mark Antanasio, who owns the Brewers, he's the majority owner. He's a very, very wealthy man. He is. Why doesn't he pay for it? The response is because he doesn't have to. He has a lease. Again, the Brewers have a lease that is a legal contract between them as the tenant and the stadium district as the landlord as to who pays for these renovations during the life of the lease. At the very, very least, the public is on the hook through the end of 2030. That's when the current lease term ends. And again, if you are an elected official, you could very honorably take a stance and say, I don't believe in this. I think when that lease ends at 2030, we shouldn't put one dime of public money into the stadium. And you can take that stance once that lease expires. But again, you have to be willing to accept the fact that they could leave. Now, maybe you think they're bluffing. Maybe they aren't. I'm just saying, if you're going to be upfront about it with your constituents, make them clear. And again, some people would be okay with that. I'm sure there are plenty of people listening to the show right now who just shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, let them leave. But if you want them to stay, you just better be aware of that.
Chris, thanks for the call. Tom, just a half minute left. What are you watching for next on this story?
Well, I think what we're watching for next is probably how this funding formula shakes out. I mean, I can tell you behind the scenes, I'm sure the city and the county's executive, the mayor of Milwaukee, I'm sure they're fighting behind the scenes to avoid having to pay any local money into this whatsoever. And when we do get, assuming we do get some separate legislation later this summer or perhaps even this fall, depending on how long it takes, it will be interesting to see how it divvies up. And if it's like a five-serve form type event where you have all three levels of local government paying a substantial share, or whether the state really does take the lion's share and maybe the city and the county play a role, but a very minor role, we don't know. But that's going to be the interesting part going forward.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it.
Tom Dakin is a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us today about proposals for financing renovations at the Milwaukee Brewers home stadium. The nation is seeing a decline in youth sports participation. In Milwaukee, some studies have pointed to barriers some inner-city kids face when it comes to playing in sports programs. But Evan Casey has this report on how one inner-city Little League program with a rich history is seeing continued success.
All right. It's a busy day here at the Beckham Stapleton Little League in Milwaukee. Players are trying out for spots on the roster at the facility's indoor practice space. That's the voice of Tawina Duncan, a coach for the league. As a kid, Duncan would help operate the scoreboard during games. Now, she gives up many of her weeknights to help volunteer. She says it's a positive way to help keep kids off the streets in the summer.
But this is something positive to get them on a straight and narrow path. It teaches them teamwork. It teaches them camaraderie. It teaches them responsibility. It teaches them that you don't have to be perfect to be successful.
The Little League was founded in 1964 by a former player for the Negro Leagues. And even today, most of its players are black. It began with just four teams. Now, over 300 children, ages 4 to 16, play against each other. Duncan's son Matthew is one of those players. He started playing baseball when he was just 5 years old.
I was screwing up, but I didn't give up and I kept trying. And now, a couple years later, I'm 12 years old, won the championship game, and going on to the juniors now.
Nationally, participation in youth sports has been declining in recent years. A report from the Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance found cost and safety concerns can keep low-income youth from playing in the league. It also found that some schools have gotten rid of their sports programs altogether. Quentin Prince played for the league as a child and is the current executive director of the Alliance. He says youth sports should be for everyone.
And so if we can elevate youth sports, give them an outlet, and allow them the opportunity to be engaged in this activity, but then also all of the benefits that come from it, you know, we could change the trajectory of so many lives in a positive way.
But it's not easy. In 2020, the Wisconsin Policy Forum found a lack of funding was the biggest challenge for youth sports organizations in the city. Many programs in Milwaukee, including the Beckham Stapleton Little League, rely on private donations and fundraising. But Prince believes the community can come together to fix the issue.
And that means the youth sports organizations working with corporate foundations, working with the school system across the board. We need just a network of partnerships where people are coming together to support this effort.
Meanwhile, the Beckham Stapleton Little League is defying the trend. It's seen what its president Jim Bray calls, quote, an explosion of players in recent years. That's largely because they now have a new softball program for girls. Bray says he spends much of his time talking to potential sponsors, since some players need help buying gloves and cleats.
Our statement is that anybody who registers will play, and we will work out, get sponsors, do whatever we can.
Since its start, coaches and volunteers with the Little League have mentored over 25,000 youth in Milwaukee. Alumni include police officers, teachers, and lawmakers. Devin Harris, a former NBA player for the Dallas Mavericks, played in the league in the 1990s. Back at league tryouts, Matthew Duncan says he has high hopes for his future baseball career.
I plan on making it to the professionals, and once I'm out of there, I plan to become a brain surgeon.
Games begin this May. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a poverty researcher joins the show to look at the impact of work requirements on federal assistance programs and the people who receive them, plus what it costs to actually implement those rules, to put them into action. As always, you can join in with your questions, your thoughts, how you'd like to see these things handled at the state and federal level. You can get started right now if you have a question or an experience to share. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow at 7 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the House Oversight Committee is pushing for information about America's withdrawal from Afghanistan. The White House says it's a political stunt by Republicans. Author Mitchell Zukov shares his new firsthand accounts from those who were in Kabul when U.S. troops finally pulled out. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, whether you're meeting somebody new or maybe catching up with someone after, say, 10 years, there's a good chance that you'll turn toward the topic of what you do for a living.
What have you been doing with your life?
Professional killer.
Oh, good for you. It's a growth industry.
Your answer may not be as dramatic as John Cusack's there in the movie Gross Point Blank, but our next guest says talking about our jobs, what we do for a living, doesn't always make for the best conversation starter. And we can do better than the what do you do question by digging into other parts of identity when we want to get to know people. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Picture the scene. You're at a party or a dinner or on the sidelines of your kid's big game or hanging out after a worship service. You meet somebody. What do you talk about? Do jobs come up? Do you wish they didn't? What do you like to talk about to get to know someone apart from their job? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Feinzig is with us. What does she do? She's the Work and Life columnist at the Wall Street Journal. She has a piece this month with the headline, Stop Telling Everyone What You Do for a Living. Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I've done this, you know, led with what I do or asking what the person does for a living. Why do you think we go there? Why do we reach for that when we're having that conversation with somebody we don't know so well?
It's so hard not to, right? Someone that I interviewed told me that it's like asking about the weather. It's just so natural. So I think most of it is just reflexive. I hesitate to say this. I was telling someone else this today and they said it was a bit of a cynical take, but there's this status competition, kind of always humming under the surface, as someone else told me for in this story. You know, maybe we secretly are curious about how much money someone makes, or we're thinking about whether they could help us, you know, in our own career. And so I do think there are other reasons that people sometimes just reach for that question, and reasons to move away from it.
Well, I think it, like the weather thing for me, you know, I'm not great at small talk, and this is easy. Like, pretty much everybody's going to have a job, or used to have a job, or will have a job. It seems like there's, it's at least some kind of common ground. Is that part of why it seems like a natural?
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, especially in this moment where we have a decent number of people, especially in the tech industry, being laid off, it can also bring up a lot of strong emotions for people. So I think you do have to tread lightly, even though it has become definitely, you know, like small talk and a polite topic.
What made you start thinking about alternatives and seeking out alternatives to the what do you do question?
You know, the story just came from this one sentence, what do you do? I just kept coming back to it. I have this kind of, you know, stream of consciousness, big, long document with ideas. And it was just really that phrase. And then I threw it out to, you know, all kinds of people doing all kinds of jobs all over the country. And that's really where the story came from and where I got ideas of better things to say, like the guy who told me that he leads with a joke. People will ask him what he does, and he says, "I make the little umbrellas that go in tropical drinks." And they're like, "Really?" And he's like, "No, no, not at all." But like, it, you know, it, like he said, it just breaks up the conversation. It kind of pulls people out of those rote scripts. And I thought that was really interesting.
Now, you talk to the host, somebody hosts a bunch of dinner parties. It looked like good sized dinner parties. But the deal is there's a ban on this. No talking about your work at this. What did you hear from about how those actually went then?
Yeah, that's the cocktail umbrella guy, John Levy. He said it's really cringeworthy at first. Like, people are often awkward. They avoid, you know, some people hit the alcohol, some people avoid the alcohol because they're scared of what they might say if they don't have this kind of crutch in hand. He told me, this didn't make it into the article, but he told me, like, the most cringeworthy is when people start comparing the spellings of their name. Like, someone will be like, "Oh, like, my aunt was Linda with a Y." You know, he's like, you know, that's when you really need to kind of intervene, when people just don't know what to say because they're so used to kind of leading with this script. But he said by the end, everyone's like a gang of old camp friends. They're kind of bonded by the fact that they have to talk about their actual interests and kind of deeper parts of who they are.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig with the Wall Street Journal. She had a piece this month about, well, that question. When you meet somebody new or reconnect with somebody, what do you do? Well, she says, hey, maybe let's talk about something other than our job. We'll probably be happy if we did. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is that your go-to in a conversation in that situation? Or do you have something else you like to bring up and talk about? What is it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I always used to ask people what they did for a living. But now that I'm retired, I find that when I go to the senior center, it's like nobody asks anybody what they what they do. I mean, eventually I might say, well, what did you used to do? You know, like, well, I used to be a social worker. I used to be a office manager, whatever, but it never comes up in the beginning because people are usually not working anymore.
It's okay if I may ask, and maybe we'll get some inspiration here. What are some of the lead topics that people come up with to talk about when everybody knows everybody else isn't working now?
Well, I think partly people, you ask them if they, of course, this might be familiar, and they might say, well, do you come here often? That sounds like a bar conversation.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And Rachel, yeah, do you come here often? That may not be the best replacement. What kind of things do you find people talking about if they say, okay, no, we're not going to do the what do you do, not do the job conversation?
Well, do you come here often? Actually, isn't a terrible starting point, this idea of asking people, like talking about where you are and what's going on and what brought them to this, you know, place where you're now meeting, is something people mentioned to me. Also asking, how do you fill your time? What brings you joy? Leading with books or movies or vacations, things kind of outside of your work and professional life, is where people, you know, told me they're trying to start now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kay, at 800-642-1234. And Rachel, part of this boils down to something you've written about before, and that's how much our job defines our identity, not to other people, but to ourselves. How, and you've experimented with this some, how can we move away from defining ourselves to ourselves by the job we're doing?
Yeah, this has been a huge topic for me. I wrote a piece last year where I talked about my own journey with running and how just having a hobby, something that was just for me, that was outside of my work, and in that case, also outside of my life as a parent of young kids, was just made me feel like a different person and gave me something else to talk about with people. So I think just having a life can be really helpful. Like, you have to have a life outside of work in order to talk about something outside of work. And so then it kind of feeds on yourself and your identity becomes less looped to, you know, how you get your paycheck.
Yeah. Do you get the sense that part of why we talk about our job is that we worry that that other stuff isn't as central to who we are? The job is the big thing, the main part of our identity that other people are going to care about?
Yeah, I think it happens because we spend so many hours of our life at work. I think it happens because so much of our confidence might come from work. One person told me she would ask people what they did because she was secretly hoping they would ask her, because saying what she did made her feel like she was someone worth talking to. And so I think a lot of us do kind of tie our jobs to our value as a person. And it can be really tough to realize, like, no, I have to figure out how to be a person without this fancy job title.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Carol is with us now in Madison. Carol, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'd kind of discovered this a long time ago. I didn't go to college, and all of my friends did. And I learned to not ask about their, you know, school, because I didn't want to have them ask me the same thing. I learned to say, what do you like to do? And one thing I wanted to also comment on is people are surprised when you say that. When you don't ask what do you do, sometimes they'll actually answer what they do for work before they even realize that you didn't ask. And I love the conversation. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, Carol, I want to ask, do people have something ready to go? Are they so, or do they have to think for a minute? What do I like to do?
Yeah, they always pause and take a breath and then they answer because they're not used to that question. Huh? It's fun.
What do you like to do, Carol?
Oh, I like to sing and dance and play music with my friends and garden, all sorts of things.
Awesome conversation starters, Carol. Thanks a lot for that. And Rachel, is this the kind of thing, like at the dinner party we were talking about, is what Carol brings up the kind of thing we end up talking about if we take work off the dinner table?
Absolutely, ideally. And just deeper things, like more points of connection between people, real points of connection, not just like, oh, I also, you know, like, do Excel spreadsheets or, you know, I'm trying to wrangle everyone to that Zoom meeting. But like real things that make us feel like fuller human beings and really connected to people in a way that, I mean, sometimes our jobs can, I think. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's okay for your job to be part of your identity. But I think when we go deeper, it can bring just a lot more life and depth to a conversation.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, about things to talk to people about when we meet them or reconnect after a long time, apart from our jobs, apart from what we do for a living, which is often, understandably, what we go to first. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you meet somebody, do you like having that conversation about your job and their job, or do you try to get into other topics? If so, what are those other topics? And do you feel like your job defines who you are in large part? Are you cool with that? Is that good? Or do you think maybe you need some other stuff out there to talk about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at The Wall Street Journal, talking about what we talk about when we meet somebody new or catch up with someone. Her suggestion, we can have better conversations, get to know each other better. If we don't start with talking about our jobs and avoid that question, what do you do? Call in now at 800-642-1234. What do you do when you're having that conversation? What do you ask about? Do jobs come up? Is that cool? Do you like to talk about different stuff? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Delafield. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm just going to try and interject a bit of humor to this. And that is, you know, I'm sure you've watched Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
You remember the episode when George was trying to date a woman and impress her? And what did he tell her? He told her he was a marine biologist. I might do that going forward, kind of like the first guy he made the little umbrellas.
Right. Mark, thanks for the call. I don't remember that episode. I'm guessing being Seinfeld, it worked perfectly with absolutely no downside. But Rachel, there's that temptation for somebody who's doing a job that people might perceive as a cool job to want to talk about that job and maybe, like you were saying earlier, want people to ask them what job they're doing and maybe not make something up like marine biologist.
It's totally understandable. And yet I think one of the risks is, especially today and in this specific economy, many jobs are not forever. And so then the hard part becomes like, who are you if you don't have that job anymore for whatever reason? And I think a lot of people struggle with that. Or who are you if the job starts burning you out and you're miserable and you don't want to be reminded of it, you know, every time you go to a dinner party? I think it can really, you know, blur those lines in a way that can be difficult for some people.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I took a psychology class when I was working on my undergrad at UWM, and we had to ask our other classmates three questions without asking them about, you know, themselves specifically, but to find out information. And one of the questions that I came up with was, I like to ask people if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want and why? Because if somebody says I'd want to be invisible because, you know, that way I can move around and no one would see me, that's more or less somebody who's probably not feeling seen or heard in the world. Where if you have somebody else where they say, I want to be invisible so that I can rob banks or I can sneak around and, you know, that's more, there's more larceny operating in that one. And I'd be a little cautious.
And Marcus, do you do this? That was in the class. Do you do this in a conversation now with the superpower question?
All the time. I find it's a great way to find out about somebody's personality. And it's such a strange question, or, you know, that some of the answers that you get too. I had one guy said that he wants the ability to be able to pick up and play any musical instrument ever. Ooh. Because he loves music and he thinks it makes people happy. Where I myself would want the ability to read and speak any language ever, because Ooh. Museums would be fantastically interesting to me.
Marcus, thanks. You may have given us an idea for a college segment in the future. That's fantastic, Marcus. Rachel, there are some creative questions there. What do you think?
I love that. I absolutely love that. I think there's probably this moment, and a few of the viewers have described this moment where people are just so used to kind of going into their shtick that they're probably like super thrown off right at first. But I imagine, you know, you just get the most fascinating answers. What a study in human psychology.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that at 800-642-1234. Talking to Rachel Feinzig with the Wall Street Journal, talking about what we talk about when we meet new people. A lot of times we'll go to the job question. She says we could try a lot of other stuff too and maybe learn more, get to know each other better. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to say, I just think it's in human nature to want to know about what a person does with their spare time and during the day. I find it that I'm always curious of what do you do for a living? Because that just lets me know what their interest is as well. So when I'm in a ski club, I mean, you would be surprised the amount, the diversity of different people that are in one club with the same interests.
Interesting, Gary. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Now, in that case, Rachel, they're all there for one reason, skiing. So they know there's a shared interest. Gary wants to know, you know, what they do in their day job, but they're not having fun skiing. I mean, you're not saying never ask about a job here.
No, I'm definitely not saying never. And look, as someone whose job is to be the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, I love hearing about what people do. I mean, that's why I have this job, right? I find it inherently interesting. I think especially people are kind of in a situation like skiing where maybe they are a little bit more relaxed and they're not just peacocking or trying to impress you, you know, at the elementary school, you know, parents' night or something. You might get some interesting anecdotes by talking about your job. And I do think that a lot of us, like, we derive a well-deserved confidence from our job. I talked to someone for the story who was the first in her family to go to college, and she loves talking about her work because it's this huge accomplishment that she has achieved. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Skip is with us now in Abbotsford. Skip, hi.
Hi, how you doing, Dave? We're doing good ourselves.
Good.
I'm a traveling folk singer storyteller. I'm on the road right now. And when I am in that position, no matter where it is, my question to somebody is, where are you from?
All right. And do you get good conversations out of that, Skip?
Oh, incredible. And if it isn't, well, I'm from, yeah, well, where are you originally? And they'll tell me, and I've met people that grew up not far from me, or we traveled in similar circles and just met most amazing people, some of whom I've put some songs together about simply by asking where you're from.
Skip, thanks a lot. Have a good tour. What do you think, Rachel? Where are you from?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, as someone who is mostly grounded in place on the East Coast with two little kids, I feel like I live vicariously by asking people, you know, where, like, what the weather looks like outside in Southern California and about their travels. And yeah, I love it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Andy in La Crosse, who couldn't stay on the line. He had a teacher who would ask people, what's your story? Well, I don't know. I don't know how I'd react to that, Rachel. I mean, I would need like a week or something to answer that. What do you think? Is that too much?
I mean, I'm here for it. And yet, yeah, I feel like it could like devolve into a therapist type situation, right? Like, you know, if someone wants to hear about like their entire upbringing and like all the issues that I have with my mother, it could go in that direction. But no, I like it. I think it's a nice way because people can take that whatever direction they want, right?
Definitely. Now, I got to ask, you meet people through your work a lot, but in your personal life, have you made a switch or do you still find yourself, Rachel, falling into, you know, what do you do?
I'm trying not to do it. Ever since starting this story, I am trying not to do it. I also, there was some advice from a career coach in the piece about how to introduce yourself. And you could say something, you know, like list a couple of hobbies, some personal things about yourself, and then include your job as almost an afterthought. So, you know, you're still kind of like maybe abiding by that social expectation, but it's kind of like a last beat, you know, in my day job, to earn a living, which I thought was a good idea. And I've been trying to do that as well.
All right. And have you tried anything that's just fallen flat? Like, this seemed like a great conversation starter and no?
I can't. I think a lot of it depends on the person you are. I haven't been able to do the what brings you joy. I just think I'm like slightly too sarcastic to pull that one off. But someone nicer than me probably could make it happen.
Yeah, story of my life too. Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Been talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal. She joined us for a look at her column on, you know, conversations. When you meet somebody for the first time, catching up with somebody in the past, what do you talk about? She says we can have a lot of great conversations if we don't go to that tried and true, what do you do? Or what do you do for a living? Or what's your job? Or lead with your job. Now, this is maybe not fair. I like talking about my job because my job is talking to people who are like really smart and interesting. And then when people find that out, there's like this halo effect where I fool them into thinking that I'm smart and interesting too. So I don't know. It doesn't work out so bad for me. Still time to share your experiences. What is your best conversation starter when you meet somebody new? Give us the line at 8ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And let us know how it works. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, movies based on books are sometimes even better than the original. We'll get some recommendations on great book-to-movie adaptations, and we hope you'll share your favorite translations. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.